This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc Olivier Dumeblay.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
I will wish everybody a happy new year and ask Yannick, what's our topic for this week?
Yannick's Linux Adventures.
Ooh, but before we start, I have a programming note and some follow-up, and you have some follow-up, so let's get into that first. So, we're doing my typical power move, which is booking vacay when you're in vacay, but here is we're back from hiatus that we are announcing yet another hiatus, and I think over the fall season we teased that this year is going to be a two short period where we have hiatus. So, we will be going into a winter hiatus, starting with episode 222 on February 11th and ending with episode 223 on March 10th. So in February, we're taking one episode off, which means for us, it's more or less a month off of podcasting. So we will be with you for the next two episodes, so this one plus two, and then we'll take another month off, and then we'll be back in March to continue this year's of Limitless Possibility. My first item of follow-up is for episode 84. It's pronounced Wazi. Yet again, I pronounce something bad in this podcast. But this is the episode where I was talking about how I would personally reimagine CarPlay. And since then, I had a shit ton of follow-up about CarPlay because you know me, I love CarPlay. And I'll have a link in the show notes from Car and Driver. But if you quickly search on the web, you'll see that Aston Martin, Porsche, and Apple have announced, more or less together, the new generation of Apple CarPlay interfaces. The one we've seen at Apple WWDC 2022 being teased. So you can see photos. They don't, in the post, let me look again. I forgot to take note of that. They don't mention the model names where they're showing. Like, if you know your car, like, especially, oh, no, they mention it, okay. For the Aston Martin, it's going to launch in 2024 in the DB12 Coupe and Convertible, or the DB12 Volante, as Aston calls it. And it seems that for Porsche, what we've this images that have been shown seems to be of the Taycan redesign, question mark. Again, they seem of a Porsche interior. But the gist of this new CarPlay generation is that CarPlay controls everything from your gauge cluster to your infotainment system to your secondary screens, especially on the passenger sides. And in the infotainment system, they also have access to all the HVAC controls and things like that. So it's interesting to see that this new generation is finally getting out. But you have to have deep pockets to experience it, because A, you need a new car, and B, you need a Porsche or an Aston Martin, so, and a new one too. So eager to see if more down to earth cars will have updates in the months to come, but glad to see that the next gen CarPlay is quote unquote finally out. Okay, what's for your follow up, Yannick?
Okay, first item of follow-up is for episode 56. This was the episode that I recorded from Japan at the Nintendo Switch reveal event.
Ooh.
And the reason we have follow-up for this episode is that I got Splatoon 2 for Christmas from my dad, and he explicitly mentioned that he remembered that episode when I played Splatoon 2 as a reason to get me the game. So that was really cool.
Huh.
So I played it a bit over the holidays. Still as fun as always. So thanks to my dad for Splatoon 2. Next item of a follow-up. On January 2nd, a magnitude 7.6 earthquake hit Ishikawa Prefecture in Japan, killing 48 people and injuring roughly 100. And I want to talk about two stories that resulted from this earthquake. The first thing is Japan finally felt the impact of Elon Musk mismanagement of Twitter. NERV, which is a disaster prevention information service, which is operated by a company known as Garin, they had their Twitter account suspended just as they were spreading critical information for citizens of the prefecture and the surrounding areas, which is not good. They are relying on the basic API tier, which essentially limits their posts to 100 posts per 24 hours, which is probably fine for most days, except it's definitely insufficient for big natural disasters like a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. And Nerve actually developed their own app because they wanted a direct channel to users to serve as a fallback when API access was initially restricted by Elon. But obviously not all their users have switched to it because Twitter is more convenient for them. And it kind of goes against the goal of the initiative to begin with. They don't necessarily want to guide users towards their own app. They just want to be present on the social media apps that everyone else is already using. Notably, they also have their own Mastodon instance, which, like, this is the thing that shocked me, is they have, like, 500,000 toots in the last, like, 4 years or something. It's, like, really a lot. They make a lot of posts. And, in fact, I had to unfollow them on Mastodon because they posted so much that it made my experience unusable. But this was still, like, during the earthquake and the following days, which had lots of aftershocks. So it's normal that they were tooting a lot on Mastodon. So, yeah, people were kind of pissed about that. It was really, like, the first time that Japan really had any reason to be angry against Elon Musk, if you can believe that, for what he did over Twitter in the last year. And it kind of woke some people up that maybe they should not stay around on Twitter if it's going to be handled like this. But yeah, so that was story number one. Second, though, sadder for me, Game Center Betty, which is an institution of music gaming arcades, was actually destroyed by the quake. It is a home to numerous incredibly rare music game cabinets from throughout history. They had a heavy presence on YouTube Live. If you're a Beatmania 2DX fan, on launch days for new versions, they would just put the cabinet on live stream on the thing so you could hear all the new songs live as everyone else is playing them, which is really, really fun. And the part that sucks for me is I was planning on going over there next month during my trip to play a game I have been trying to find a cabinet for over 10 years. So I'm not going to be able to play that game, unfortunately. The timing really sucks there. But ultimately, like, the owner and all of the cats that stay at the arcade have are safe. So they are fine. The only thing is the cabinets and the arcade is not fine. So at least they are all safe, and we can deal with the material losses. There is some sort of crowdfunding campaign you can participate to, and they have, like, an equivalent to a Patreon if you want to support them on a regular basis. Currently, the owner, despite being safe, is still homeless, so they would appreciate the support, I'm sure.
Oh, that sucks.
So for our last item of follow-up, we kind of have joint follow-up again.
Yes.
We did the Game of the Year episode last time, and we didn't really have any plans going forward into the next year. I saw a video late in the year that basically hinted at you should do a backlog bingo. You should, like, have a 25-game board where you just put a bunch of games that you're interested in playing and try to hit a bingo by the end of the year, which I think is a pretty neat idea. And there were definitely more than 25 games that I was interested in playing. So I made a board.
I was curious to know where you came up with this bingo idea and then the number 25 too. So I guess that explains why.
Yeah, obviously I'm not going to play all 25 games throughout the year. I'm going to try to at least finish five. But yeah, that's where the idea came from. I'll try to put a link to the video in the show notes in case you can do that. There is also a webpage on my website you can visit where you can see the board for yourself. And I will be posting a little paragraph for each game that I finish on the board as I finish them. So far, no games, but you can track my progress there throughout the year. And then we'll be able to revisit it at the end of the year. But I know that Ricardo has done something similar completely by coincidence.
Yeah, and it is from a different inspiration. And I'll have a link in the show because it is from the year in review. I think they call it the 2023 game we've played from My Life in Gaming. Boy, this video is A, great, and B, long. So don't be surprised when you press play and you need 90 minutes because it is 90 minutes long. But well worth your time. And I forgot to take note of it when I watched it. And in preparation for re-recording, I did have the time to watch it another time. But my recollection is this concept of a pledge list is something that both Mark and Corey have been starting to do recently. I think it's maybe the second or the third like year in review episodes where they've done that. I think it's the second.
They did their first pledge list last year, so.
Yeah, and they've done again this year. So all of this is to say is it's a recent concept they've decided to do, and I won't spoil it, but I think you should go watch the video because they describe how well they've done. And related to, I guess, our own Game of the Year episode and even my own journey of the past few years, I've decided to put on some kind of paper, because it's all digital, but at first it was all written, the games I had on kind of, I had on my to-do list. And that's why I decided to borrow their concept of building a pledge list, and even try to stay close to their number, because they usually pledge for 10 games that they really want to complete or play by the end of the next year. And for me, I've used the same tool that Yannick has built, but I decided to keep it in a grid and I've pledged to 9 games. So I'll have a link in the show notes because I didn't put it on my own website, but I did post it on Mastodon, so I can be referred there.
Did you actually post it on Mastodon? I didn't see it.
I did. That was some of the stuff I did in preparation for recording this episode. So I've done that in literally in the past hour.
Oh, that's why I didn't see it.
Yes, yeah, it's pretty recent. But I have some notes into, I won't talk about them today because I really want to keep that for next year's Game of the Year episode. But building the list was hard. I'll just tease it like this, but I've end up with 9 games, and like I mentioned on my Mastodon post, I've already completed 1. So in theory, I've pledged to 9 games, and I was already more like, I think, halfway done when I committed to those 9 games for 1. So I've rolled the credits on it. So I am now down to 8 games to play for the remainder of the next 10 months, let's put it this way, to follow Yannick's rule for our own Game of the Year episode. So till October.
Nice.
Good. And Yannick, let's go into your main topic.
I wasn't sure what to call this topic because it's been a crazy ride through a bunch of different things regarding Linux. So I decided to just title it Yannick's Linux Adventures, and we'll see where it takes us. Last year, I got to play around with Linux in a professional setting again. I worked on embedded Linux systems twice at work last year. I had to increase my reliance on Windows subsystem for Linux when working on my work laptop because a bunch of tools were making me very upset in Windows. And I got a work opportunity to potentially specialize in supporting the creation of custom embedded Linux images. And it reminded me of how much I actually enjoy playing around with Linux. And that's sort of what prompted me to do the old computer challenge last summer, if you remember that episode. If you haven't heard that episode, I got myself an EPC with 512 megabytes of RAM, and I tried to use it as a daily driver for an entire week. But because of the low specs, I had to play with some somewhat scuffed and outdated distributions. So it wasn't really an ideal testing ground for what modern Linux today looks like. And the combination of both those experiences really got me in the mood to give modern Linux a try again. So we talked about the modernization of desktop Linux back in episode 153. I think that was like almost 5 years ago now. And despite being interested in the topic vaguely, I hadn't had hands-on experience with contemporary Linux since around 2010, 2011. So the last time I was using Linux regularly, I was maintaining an Arch Linux install and primarily using Tiling Window Managers or OpenBox as my window manager. And all of this was predating the widespread adoption of things like Systemd, Wayland, free desktop portals, Pipewire, all of these core technologies that everyone expects on a Linux desktop today. None of that existed back then, or it was in the infancy stage back in the day. And I just knew that a lot had changed in the last decade, and I wanted to play around with it again for my personal computing and development needs. And that's kind of what this episode is going to be all about. But before, I want to have a brief diversion to follow up on the EPC. During the old computer challenge, I used a weird Swiss Linux distribution called Slita's Linux.
like Swiss?
The country.
Swiss is a country. Okay.
Yes.
Just make sure.
And one of my major complaints about that distribution was how unreliable the packaging seemed to be. There were package repos, and the packages would install just fine, but they would often complain about missing or incorrect dependencies at runtime, which sucked. You basically had no sense that the majority of packages would work. You had the feeling that there was no quality control at all to ensure that the entirety of the packages offered by the distribution was cohesive. So this random Linux distribution had such a limited number of packages to begin with, and all of these dependency issues just further restrained what you could realistically install on top of it. And I didn't have the greatest experience. It was still a fun challenge, but I didn't do as much as I had hoped I could during that week. And in retrospect, it seems kind of obvious that I should have chosen to go with Alpine Linux. Alpine Linux is an incredibly lightweight Linux distribution that's incredibly popular for use in Docker containers because of how small it is. A base install of Alpine is about 130 megabytes, and wow, you can generally comfortably boot these systems with less than 100 megs of RAM. It still supports 32-bit Intel. In fact, I have seen numerous YouTube videos of people installing it on a Pentium 1 CPU to this day, and it works great. And it has incredibly rich package repositories with the level of quality control that I expect and I want out of a distribution. And the reason it didn't come to mind last year when I was doing the challenge is that I had always had this idea in my head that Alpine is a server distro and that it's not really usable as a desktop. But apparently that's not true. I could have found a tiling window manager or something that would have worked great on the EPC. And anyways, with the screen of the EPC being 7 inches, you generally don't want to use a giant desktop environment with tons of Chrome anyway. You probably just want a tiling window manager on that computer. So if I had to do the old computer challenge again, or if I do it again this year, Alpine is definitely going to be one of my top candidates on the list of potential OSs, because it's a lot more viable as a daily driver than I originally thought on this hardware. So now that we've gotten the retro laptop out of the way, we can actually get to the meat of this episode and talk about new machine number one, my modern, quote unquote, modern laptop called Ataraxia, which is a ThinkPad X260. So I had been toying around with the idea of setting up a dedicated computer for Japanese language immersion. So what I wanted was a desktop environment running entirely in Japanese, supporting Japanese text entry. It needs to be able to run Anki, which is the flashcard software that I use for vocabulary. This is a Qt application, so it does run on Linux, like that's not a problem. And I mostly intended to browse like Japanese websites and watch TV shows and anime that I have locally downloaded. Nothing super extravagant, right? It sounds like stuff that desktop Linux should be more than capable of accomplishing. And in parallel to that, in a Cathode Ray Dude video, he mentioned offhand how he had recently picked up a ThinkPad X260 and he was absolutely in love with it, so I decided to look into it. And I knew that the ThinkPad X200 series of laptops is historically beloved by Linux and BSD nerds for being incredibly well supported in terms of hardware support. And after mentioning it to Ducadivier, he reminded me that it's essentially the follow-up to his own X250, which we talked about on episode 160.
Yes. And that you not explicitly recommended, but the resources when I told you, hey, I'm kind of thinking to get the Windows PC, and people say ThinkPads are good, and they would be pretty flexible for me to dick around with a non-Mac computer. And you sent me those links that was kind of explaining what could I do with X series ThinkPad, or like a bunch of series of ThinkPads, and compare them for that. So it was funny because the X series of ThinkPad were pretty high in the list on a lot of the resources you sent me at that time.
Yep. So I ended up finding one for about $200 Canadian on eBay with an i5-6300U at 2.4 gigahertz. For me, that seems like a perfectly reasonable price, although you can find some for cheaper. It's just I wasn't that picky about the price.
Hey, and it's cheaper than I paid, 3 years ago at this point? I think it was in 2020 that I bought mine.
Yeah.
I think you paid $100 less for a newer generation, so.
Yeah. Both the RAM and the SSD are upgradable, so I also took advantage and grabbed 2 8-gigabyte sticks of RAM and 1 terabyte SSD to throw in there. So the big question is, what Linux distribution did I go with? So since I was primarily interested in like the Japanese language support, I decided to go look around on Japanese Linux YouTube, and there are a bunch of Japanese Linux YouTubers that play with some really weird Linux distributions I've never heard of. The one that stood out to me and the one that had the most name recognition to me, aside from like the Ubuntu's and all of that stuff, was Linux Mint. Linux Mint is a distribution that's derived from Ubuntu LTS releases. So that means you essentially get a new major version of Linux Mint every 2 years, because Ubuntu LTS long-term support releases are released every 2 years on the even years. And back in the day, Linux Mint was known to provide a better out-of-the-box experience for Linux to less technical users than name-brand Ubuntu. For example, back in the day, when you installed Ubuntu, you couldn't actually play any H.264 video because that's a no-no. You can't have the proprietary codecs in mainline Ubuntu. They have relaxed a lot of this stuff over the years, but back in the day, that's kind of what Linux Mint was known for. But I didn't go with straight Linux Mint. I went with Linux Mint Debian Edition. So in recent years, Canonical has been making a lot of questionable business-motivated decisions in Ubuntu, and Linux Mint has put some work into undoing a lot of the bigger ones. And what Linux Mint Debian Edition is essentially a Plan B project, which is on standby and background in case Ubuntu ever makes a change so controversial that Linux Mint feels that they can't actually rely on it as a base for the mainline version anymore. So in practice, LMDE is an extra stable variant of the Linux Mint distribution built on top of the Debian software repos instead of the Ubuntu repos. And if you're not super familiar with like the background behind like what the relationship with Ubuntu and Debian is, Ubuntu is essentially like a polished version of the Debian unstable branch. So it gets more frequent software updates than every 2 years like regular Debian does. And then Ubuntu's effort really goes into stabilizing what is the unstable tree of Debian on a regular basis. So that's why I say it's an extra stable variant. It's because they're taking Debian stable and they're just sticking with Debian stable, which has a lot much longer cycle than the average Ubuntu distribution does. And because of this, LMDE sidesteps a lot of the drama that is inherent with modern Ubuntu, such as Ubuntu recently started only offering specific security updates behind an Ubuntu Pro subscription, which pissed off a lot of people. there's also the increasingly aggressive push of Snaps as an application package manager, which is going against Flatpak, which is kind of what everyone else has adopted. But Snaps are owned by Canonical, so obviously they want to push their own thing. So LMDE kind of says, hey, I don't even want to be on the periphery of this bullshit. I just want to engage with Debian instead of Ubuntu, and you are saved from all of that going down the line. I want to give some thoughts on some of the software that I dealt with on this machine, starting off with Cinnamon, which is the desktop environment provided by Linux Mint. In the early days when GNOME 3 was being planned out, they didn't really like where GNOME was taking the desktop. So they forked GNOME 3 and they created their own environment, which is known as Cinnamon, which I happen to really, really like. Modern day Cinnamon out of the box looks very similar to Windows 10 out of the box, which makes it super approachable to people who are switching from Windows. And from what I can tell, a lot of people are switching from Windows these days because Windows 10 support is winding down very soon. And Windows 11 has a bunch of ads everywhere. So that's not cool. And I mean, Windows 10 has ads in it as well. Frequently I'm at work and it's telling me, hey, why are you working? You should be playing Quake 2 on Game Pass. And I'm like, I wish I could play Quake 2 on Game Pass, but I'm working right now. My personal preferences are such that I vastly prefer GTK as a widget framework to Qt, which is used in the KDE environment. So I tend to greatly favor GTK-based desktop environments on my own personal machines. And obviously, like, when you think of GTK, you think of GNOME, which is, I mean, they run GTK. But the problem is, I think GNOME is a bit too eager to repeat the same design mistakes that modern Apple is making in macOS and iPadOS. And I prefer something that is much more aligned with the more reasonable design of GTK3 apps than the essentially iPadOS copy that is GTK4 and Libadwaita apps. I really disagree with the idea that basically GNOME should copy everything the Mac does without asking any questions about it. It kind of sucks. Cinnamon also comes with a bunch of really cool applications, and especially like Cinnamon and Linux Mint gets additional ones on top of that. So the first thing is the Update Manager. The Update Manager is the nicest software update manager I've seen across all Linux distros, and it universally handles apt packages, Flatpaks, which we'll talk about in a bit, and Cinnamon Spices, which are Cinnamon plugins, except they're called spices because it's cute like that. They also have the Mint Software Manager, which is like the App Store equivalent. It's a graphical front end to both the apt repositories and the Flatpak repositories. And again, you compare it to all of the other front ends to these from other desktop environments like GNOME Software or KDE Discover. The Mint Software Manager is one of the best ones. I think the new Ubuntu one, if you ignore all the drama around snaps, is also very good. But the Mint Software Manager is my personal favorite. They bundle an application called TimeShift, which is essentially the Windows ME System Restore utility, except if I say that, it's not going to sell you on it because that one worked terribly. So imagine that, but it works. And what this does is lets you revert to a system checkpoint before a potentially problematic update was installed without touching your data. Although you can technically configure it to also use it as a more general backup utility, like a kind of time machine thing, if you want to. Celluloid is a really nice video player. It reminds me a lot of Ina on the Mac, so I like that a lot. I also really like the super minimal USB drive formatting and flashing utilities a lot. So there's that. And then specific to my use case, Cinnamon's language and locale switcher guides you through the process of installing everything you need to input text in the language you are switching to, which shockingly is not something that most distributions do. Most Linux distributions, if you decide, hey, I'm switching my language and my locale to Japanese, it will change the language of the OS to Japanese, and it will just stop there, and you will just have to figure out how to install the input manager to actually be able to type in that language on your own. And that's a completely shitty experience, but Cinnamon just guides you through it, and it's a really nice experience.
Hey, I do have a similar experience. I kind of was teasing, a future section, but I tried it in French, and it did work too. I was greatly surprised.
Yeah, because you also installed LMD, I think, over the holidays.
That's not how I wanted to introduce it. I kind of wanted you to finish your tour. So I'll finish there, and I'll want to come back to how easy it is to install, because I have a lot to say about that.
Sure. Okay. Next up, I want to talk about Wayland. And my header in my notes is Wayland? ? So if you don't remember, Wayland is the new display server that is slowly replacing X11 in the Linux world. And it drops a lot of the design mistakes and baggage of X11 to catch up to other OSs. If you didn't listen to the episode we did about the modernization of the Linux desktop, essentially they saw the iPhone being demoed for the first time and they were like, shit, we have to dump X11. We are never going to be able to compete with this user experience on Linux. And they were right. At time of recording, Cinnamon does not ship with a Wayland session. Linux Mint developers have been rather quiet about migrating to Wayland until earlier this fall, when they actually announced that Linux Mint 21.3 would be the first release to include an experimental Wayland session for the Cinnamon desktop. That version is currently in beta, although given the time we are recording right now, it's very likely going to be out this weekend by the time you hear this, and those changes should also roll out to LMDE6 in a timely manner as well. So for me, better late than never, I guess. I was getting very concerned that the Linux Mint devs had no public plans to adopt Wayland anytime soon, back during the summer. And it's nice to see them finally acknowledge that Wayland exists in any way and slowly make moves in that direction. Because I think Cinnamon, like, it's a really good experience for an X11 desktop, but I feel like it's still being held back by the limitations of X11. And I think, like, their touchpad gestures could be so good if they were running in Wayland and other related things. They could be much better. It's just they weren't taking the initiative to get on it, and now they are getting on it. So, about time.
Yeah, and I would even add on that, it adds still this kind of feeling of unpolished, even if it is a polished experience. And that is something that greatly surprised me too, that the Cinnamon window management system is kind of like, it provides an experience I was not expecting to have on a Linux distro.
Interesting. Next up on the docket is Flatpak. Flatpak is a universal application distribution format that was popularized by GNOME and Red Hat developers. And essentially what this does is it's a way for developers to package their own applications and deliver directly to users without needing to rely on Linux distribution packagers for updates. Because again, like I said, Debian, they have a 2-year cycle and they only do security and minor bug fix updates. So if you have a new version of your app, you don't necessarily want to have to wait 2 years before they get an update that is probably going to be outdated by the time it goes through the feature freeze for Debian 13. So it is currently the de facto standard, which is compatible with most, if not all, distributions, though not necessarily out of the box. So like I said, Ubuntu notably does not ship with Flatpak support out of the box because they would rather you use snaps, even though basically no one wants to use snaps, but you can still install it and they'll work. Basically the way it works is your app targets a known platform container, which is provided by the application repository. And if there are any additional dependencies you need to include, you just package them with your application, kind of like app bundles work on the Mac, to be honest, where we have all of our dilibs right in the app bundle. You basically do the same thing, except instead of using whatever the dependencies of the OS are, you're using the dependencies of a common container for Flatpak apps. So for example, if you're making a GTK application, there is a GTK up-to-date container you can build and test against, and everyone who uses Flatpak is using that container environment. The user experience for Flatpak has improved a lot in the last year, and that's to say that I did run into issues with Flatpak, and especially early on. So I was running into things where light and dark mode settings, for example, weren't being propagated to Flatpak apps. So I was getting flashbanged by anything I installed in Flatpak because I was running in dark mode and suddenly this giant white window shows up in my face. I had another issue where all of the fonts for Flatpak apps would just display squares instead of characters for the text that was being displayed in the app, which is not great, especially when you're using an app that is mostly text. So that was not ideal. But over time, all of these issues just ironed themselves out, mainly with the upgrade to LMDE6, which was based on Debian 12. So I think like Debian 11 being essentially a 2-year-old distribution at the tail end of when I was using LMDE5, when LMDE6 wasn't out yet, it's possible that I was using features that were not available in Debian 11 necessarily, and they were just breaking, or they weren't implemented in the right way in Debian 11. I'm not too sure. It sounds like there are also still certain issues with sandboxed apps, which allow you to, which require you to install like another side application to poke holes in the sandbox that aren't normally there. But I haven't run into any of them myself. The main thing that I think is weird about Flatpak is for non-technical users. When you go to the software manager, I can see those users being really confused by why there are two different versions of the same app in the software manager, and nothing ever really tells you which one you should be picking. So for example, like if you want, there's a dictionary application in KDE, for example, a Japanese dictionary application in KDE, And you go search for it in the thing, and it shows up as a Flatpak in an app version. You can probably guess by the fact that the apt version is older than the Flatpak version that you should probably be installing the new version, but it's not clear why you're seeing two of them and why it's not just presenting the newer version. Also, the apt version is presented as being a system package. So does system package imply better package? It's like there's a bunch of weird UI things that are not clear to non-technical users that if you don't know what the pros and cons of all the different packaging systems are, you aren't necessarily sure which one you should install and what the trade-offs are and the potential issues are with each of these approaches. So there are still a couple paper cuts there.
I did experience this.
Oh.
I wanted to try... It's available on the Mac, but I never found the time to install it. But I wanted to try the Darktable photo editor.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, hey, you know, I have a Linux box now, so maybe it's time to just try it. And you're correct. I searched for it, and there were two versions. And I was like, which one should I choose? And I think I remember seeing one that mentioned the word Flatpak in it. But I forgot if it was that one that had an older version or the other source. But in the end, I just said, oh, this one is the newer version. So that's the one I want. And then I installed this one.
Yeah. And another weird thing is since apt is technically a command line package manager, like there's no notion of like screenshots or icons for most of those packages. Like there is a metadata field for them, but most packages just leave them blank because why would you? It's a command line package manager. So you have the thing where Flatpak having a web front end has all of this rich metadata, which makes it seem like the most more appealing choice. And then you have the app version that's there that just looks like you're not even sure if the package is working correctly because it doesn't even have an icon. It doesn't have screenshots. You're like, well, what the fuck is going on here? And it's like, it makes sense if you know what's going on, but you can't expect a non-technical user to know what's going on. Next up is systemd. So on that desktop Linux modernization episode, I mentioned that there was a big migration to systemd, which is an init system, and it was a big event that I had missed during my time away from Linux. Essentially, systemd was still being discussed as something to come when I left, and I missed the whole transition. So I'm using it for the first time roughly a decade after the migration took place, and I'm sure that a lot of things that were problems back then that people complained about have been smoothed out over the years. But despite that, I do think that a lot of the continued complaints about systemd and its monolithic design and unsurprisingly ongoing scope creep are highly justified. The other day, everyone on my Mastodon timeline had borked DNS because of systemd resolved d, which is the new DNS resolution thing, and I got flashbacks to the macOS discovery d days when everyone had broken DNS. So that was fun. But I also want to point out my positive experience with this, which is a lot more Linux knowledge has become transferable between wildly different environments because you can now make a pretty safe assumption that systemd is going to be there in 90 to 95% of cases. And what I mean by that is things that you learn on your laptop can carry over to configuring embedded Linux boards if you want to. And a couple of years ago, that just wasn't the case. You could find completely different init systems in completely different environments. And now everyone has sort of converged on systemd because it does everything. And you can learn one init system and deploy those skills in a variety of different environments. And that was cool when I had to configure actual systemd targets as part of work a couple months ago, and I was shipping I think I wrote like two different systemd targets that are in shipping products now, and the only reason I have that knowledge is because I was doing some tinkering on the side on my laptop. And I think that's really cool because if I had to learn a completely different init system, then I would just have more knowledge that is very specific to like this one environment. So that part of it is cool. Before we move on to the next computer in my lineup, I do want to give some brief hardware thoughts. So if you want to jump in with some software thoughts on Linux Mint Debian Edition, you are free to join in.
I would, please, because the main reason why I'm also trying Linux Mint Debian is because over the holiday I was trying to find a tinkering project. I always find something that I do, like, that will take me a whole afternoon, a whole day, like afternoon and evening, during the holiday break, just that is computer related. I think 1 year, for example, was literally fully erasing my old iMac and making sure it was ready to be sent to the Apple Store. I recall that was during the pandemic, just after I moved. Like, and that took a full day because I wanted to make sure that either the data that was on it was already moved somewhere else or things like that. You know, computer stuff that computer nerds like Yannick and I love to do because they just want to tinker on computers. So I was like, Yannick, I have this ThinkPad that I sometimes use for Windows 10, but these days it's just a gathering dust. So if I want to tinker with Linux, what would be your suggestion? And as a good friend, Yannick suggested Linux Mint and Debian. The problem is there's no tinkering with it. Literally. I grabbed the ISO file. I think the worst tinkering I had to do was figure out how to flash the ISO file on my USB stick from my Mac. Because you mentioned that I think you were already using Linux, more or less. And I think you mentioned this tool in Mint, that is to flash hard drive, that is super nice. I was like, oh. So that was not the hardest part, but again, most example I found was using DD, and I'm like, oh boy. I understand the syntax of DD just enough to ensure that this comment on the web is not going to erase my whole hard drive.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, that didn't happen. But after that, it has what I would call a modern install wizard,
mm-hmm.
or even like an install wizard. Once it's fully installed, you go to the system manager. You might end up with a few updates because, hey, it's a modern operating system, whether it's Mac, Windows, or Linux, like, it needs constant update. If you just press update, it does all that. When you first launch, there's also a lot of notification that are like suggestion. Hey, you should do this, you should do that. One example is the time shift feature that you mentioned. The backups. I wasn't sure if it was time shift or time sync, so that's why I was asking.
Yeah, it's time shift.
But time shift, they strongly suggest you should configure it in case you fucked up. I was like, oh, okay. I'm not sure what it really entails as a backup or whether it was a backup solution or a snapshotting solution. But you confirmed that it was more of it can do both, but it's more to snapshot your install.
By default, it only does the system restore thing.
Right. Which I think it's nice that it suggests you do so. And you can decide whether or not you want to do it. Just for the fun of it, my hard drive is encrypted because I was like, hey, let me try encryption on Linux distros.
You were braver than me. I didn't do that.
Because, you know what, like, I didn't care, right? If I need to literally erase the SSD again and start from scratch, I'm like, I don't care. There's nothing really valuable in it right now. But I'm like, let's try that and see how it all goes. And guess what? I need to input 2 passwords to open my session, to boot the laptop and then open my session. But more than that, it just works. So your description that it is, dare I say, a kind of fully fledged, but the fact that it's really simple to install, it is giving you, for me, it was giving me the feeling of a modern operating system. And what I mean by that is you can do advanced functionalities, like you can always do with Linux distribution. If you want a GUI for doing this, there's a GUI to do that. And you know what? It's not ugly. It is pretty, even if it's based on the old X11 system and things like that. It works nice. For sure, it's not full of animation like we're used to with macOS and things like that. But it's pretty and it does the job. So I was kind of disappointed, let's be honest. Not on the distro itself, but on the fact that I didn't have a tinkering project in the end.
You should have said, like, I want an actual project, because I could have guided you, like, go install Alpine, go install Void Linux, go install Gentoo if you want to build shit for 3 days.
You know what? You're correct. But my assumption was that Linux in 2023, 2024 is still like that, right? I was so foreign to me. I assume my experience from when we were in CJIP installing it and what I did on my netbook around 2008, 2009, was like, that's what Linux still is. So I'm really glad to see that there are distros nowadays that can give you a turnkey experience. And for the maybe 3 or 4 hours I just dick around inside Linux Mint Debian, it seems pretty neat. Now I just realized that I need a real project with it. So I haven't figured that out, but right now it's plugged in. And one day I'll figure a project. I'll be like, hey, maybe I could try to do that there. But yeah, that's kind of my small summary / review of it, where I was greatly surprised on modern Linux distros, especially this one.
Yeah, two thumbs up from us. So hardware thoughts. It seems weird to go into the hardware thoughts section and then immediately start the sentence with, I gave Fedora Silverblue a shot, and I was shocked to find out that A, this laptop has a fingerprint reader.
And it does.
B, it's supported out of the box if you actually use a desktop environment that has support for fingerprint readers, which Cinnamon does not, but ooh, GNOME does. So when I was setting it up, it was like, hey, you want to set up your fingerprint reader? And I'm like, where the fuck is the fingerprint reader? I didn't know it had one. So that was cool.
What's your experience with it? I assume you didn't try it with the Windows installed either, right?
I didn't even configure it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I just know that it works.
Because it's from the, I don't know if it's the same generation, if they changed it, but the one I have on my X250, it's okay. Again, it doesn't work on Linux, but on my Windows install it does. And it's kind of one of those where you have to swipe your finger above it. And when you used to, even Touch ID Gen 1, like, it's miles ahead to that, so...
Yeah, that's pretty much why I didn't bother. Next point, having three USB 3 ports, an Ethernet port, an SD card reader, and an onboard cellular modem in the same machine feels like getting away with a crime. Like, ooh, as an Apple user, I am not used to having that much stuff. Like, technically, like, my M2 MacBook Pro has three Thunderbolt ports now. So, I mean, I'm closer to that, but having all of that choice of ports and such a small machine, it's really cool to tinker with, man.
So when you upgraded the SSD and the RAM, you confirmed you add the cellular modem too. Because the reason I ask is because, for example, mine has the SIM tray and everything, but if you follow the antenna cable, they go to a N2 connector where the cellular modem would be if it was in my machine, for example. So don't rely on the fact that it has a SIM tray to mention that it has a cellular modem. That's what I learned when dicking around with mine a few years ago.
Okay, I'll have to check. But
your point's still valid that you could buy the card and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. The top cover on my ThinkPad arrived in a really rough shape, but I took that to actually be a positive, because since it was already worn in, I didn't feel any hesitation towards putting stickers on it. I never put stickers on my computers, but now I did. And I think I made my laptop look pretty good, and it's cool. It's actually nice to have something that you don't actually have to treat like it's your child, and you can just throw it around and not care so much about it. That part of the ThinkPad experience is really cool. The only real downside I have with the hardware is going to echo things that you said on your episode, which is to say that this model came with the 1366x768 TN panel instead of either of the IPS options, which means it has awful viewing angles, low brightness, and less than half the contrast ratio of the IPS options. Luckily, the panel is user upgradable to IPS, either one of the same resolution or a 1080p panel. So it is a potential upgrade path down the line, and I am strongly considering it, even though from a cost perspective, it makes zero sense. But I love this computer, and I kind of want to update it anyway.
Yeah, after the fact, what I found, and I forgot if I mentioned this when I did the review episode, but I think the upgrade is about $200 for the part itself on eBay and things like that. And similar model that has the panel would be maybe like $150 extra. It's like lower or close to the extra. But again, usually those models are also, they might have the cellular modem already included because they were considered more premium versions. So it's a nice upgrade to do, I assume, because IPS display, but for sure, far from cost effective.
And the last thing I want to say about the hardware before moving on to the next machine is that there were a bunch of different battery options for these ThinkPads, and I have both the integrated battery and the removable battery. I'm nice. Not sure which of the options I have, but essentially, like, I get around 9 to 10 hours of battery life watching video, and this is on Linux. So when I had power outages a couple months ago, I just stayed in bed and watched Gundam the whole time on my laptop, and it was really solid, and I was very impressed with the battery life, because I think we lost power for like something like 18 hours or something like that a couple of months ago. So yeah, that was very appreciated, because I had literally nothing else to do.
Yeah, no, 9-10 hours is pretty neat, because with mine, I was still surprised, because Windows laptop in general, but I think with mine on Windows, I was getting 5 hours with both batteries, which still was like, wow, for me. But 9-10 was even better.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the server. So my server is called Peacecraft, and it is an HP T260. And the HP T260 is not a machine you have probably heard of. It is a thin client computer, which was mainly meant to operate as a remote desktop client in corporate settings. So you probably are not going to see very many people who are excited about this machine. But what that means is that companies buy boatloads of these, and they rotate them out after a couple of years. And you can find these for $20 to $50, which is not bad. In fact, it's actually probably cheaper than any of the Raspberry Pis you can find on the market today. And ultimately, it's just a low-power AMD machine with a 1.5 gigahertz quad-core processor. At least that's the configuration I have. There's a dual-core version as well. And a Radeon HD 8330E integrated graphics. So because this is AMD integrated graphics, it is going to perform a lot better than Intel. And ultimately, I wanted a basic file server to integrate into my video production pipeline, because I realized when I was thinking about it that each of my videos is produced across multiple devices. The script writing happens basically anywhere. The swan song footage is generally recorded on a Windows PC, but then I transfer it to the Mac to upscale it. The voiceovers are recorded and edited on the Mac. The video editing is done on the iPad, and then I upload it to YouTube on the Mac. So it just goes all over the place. And originally, I was using an external Samsung SSD on the Mac to serve as a sort of repository for all of these files. And I mean, I still use it for that today, even with the server, just as a working space. But I found that the Mac's file sharing is extremely flaky in my setup for some reason. Every single time I was recording a video, I felt like I was spending 5 to 10 minutes fighting the file sharing just to get my two machines to see each other, which I really hated. Luckily, the hardware requirements for a home file server are not very high, nor do they ever really grow. So this machine is more than adequate at the job for the time being. Now, this is where I should have done more research before buying this machine. It's kind of a shitty plug-and-play device for this kind of purpose, and it'll be immediately obvious why. So this HP T260 has a broken UEFI implementation. When it tries to boot, it looks at the wrong path for critical boot files, and unfortunately what this means is if you try to install many Linux distributions to this machine, your final install will not boot.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. This appears to be more common with Debian derivatives. So I was installing Debian and I would just reboot and it would just say no operating system. And I was like, well, fuck, what the fuck are you doing then, installer? And what I found out after lots of searching is that you manually have to go in with safe mode and fix the UEFI file paths so that it actually finds the file. And luckily, you only have to do it once. I was worried that I would have to do it every single time that Grub updates. Luckily, that is not the case, because that would be a major pain in the ass. But that was just the first problem with this machine. The second problem is that the Wi-Fi drivers for the card are not widely distributed out of the box by most Linux distributions because it is a proprietary driver. So you will probably have to do some sort of project package management dance to get these installed. I did. And the reason I'm using Wi-Fi at all and not Ethernet is because my server is in my living room closet, and my living room closet is just not particularly well placed to route Ethernet cables to. So right now I don't really have much of a choice to use Wi-Fi anyway. And also all of my Ethernet ports on my router right now are in use, so I would have to buy a switch or something like that. Not that it's a huge expense, but I just don't have the port for it right now. These complications actually made me change my planned distribution. Originally I was debating between using a vanilla Debian 12 installer or Open Media Vault, which is a Debian derivative that actually provides kind of an out-of-the-box NAS experience. You can just log into a web front end and manage your volumes directly over the web. It seemed really polished, but neither of them would boot, obviously, which was a problem. And I also had like the Wi-Fi issues on all of these as well. So ultimately what I ended up doing is I just installed Linux Mint Debian Edition on the server as well. Now you're going to say, well, that's a waste of resources. You're installing a GUI on a device that you're not even going to have a screen connected to 99% of the time. And that is true. But the main thing is because I wasn't sure what I was doing for the Wi-Fi driver install, I wanted to make sure that I at least knew that I was setting up the Wi-Fi correctly. And in Debian 12 and in Open Media Vault, I would have to do this Wi-Fi configuration over the command line. And I haven't done that in like 12 years. So the tools have probably changed because of systemd. And I just wanted to eliminate the risk that I was fucking up the configuration of the Wi-Fi when I was trying to figure out if these Wi-Fi drivers were installing. So now that I know how to install the driver, I could probably switch to these distributions just fine. And I would only have to figure out how to configure the Wi-Fi and it would be fine. But the server's already set up, so why would I do that?
But unlike with the ThinkPad, I don't know if it was your experience, but I remembered, like, for me, it was just, it figured out the driver and then that's it.
Yeah.
For this machine, you had to do manually install the driver?
Yes.
Wow.
And that is one of the differentiating factors, actually, between regular Linux Mint and Mint Debian Edition, is that regular Linux Mint actually has Ubuntu's driver manager built into it, so it will automatically detect hardware and try to install the drivers for you. Whereas Debian Edition, since it's relying on an Ubuntu component, that thing is not there, so you can't actually use it in that scenario. So that is one differentiating factor, which could make vanilla Linux Mint more more interesting for people with weirder hardware. I don't know why I didn't think to install regular Linux Mint. Like, I honestly don't know what I was thinking. I think I was just too allergic to Ubuntu.
Yeah, I was about to say that. I think if there's something that I know from you and Linux Distro is you're literally allergic to Ubuntu.
But then, like, a couple of weeks later, I literally installed Linux Mint 21.2, which is the Ubuntu-based one, on my laptop, right? So, I mean, like, I installed it anyway. I just don't know why I didn't think of it when I was setting up the server. I don't know. I don't know. I must have been on drugs or something.
Oh, wow. That went out quickly.
Yeah. So anyway, now that the server is running, let's talk about what I installed on it. So the first thing I installed is the unattended upgrades package. And actually, like, on the side, it's not a hardware machine that I have in the house, but I also have a Linux server in the cloud on Linode running Debian 12. And that is where I learned about unattended upgrades. It is a background service provided by Debian that automatically installs security updates to your server on a regular interval, once a day by default. And it has a bunch of really cool features. Like, you can configure it to automatically email you the list of updates that it applied via email. I don't have an SMTP server to put into it, but in theory, I could set it up. And you can even use another package called Need Restart, which is actually going to look at the list of packages that were updated and identify which ones actually need to be need a full reboot of the machine to be applied, like kernel updates and stuff like that. So there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with unattended upgrades. And if you just want to set up a machine and just leave it running and make sure that it stays relatively secure, then unattended upgrades is a great way to ensure that you don't have to do any upkeep on your machine and it'll stay 99% safe. Then I set up external storage. So external USB storage with BTRFS. The T260 has a surprising amount of USB ports. It has six. It has two USB 3.0 ports and four USB 2.0 ports. All of them are USB-A. And in recent years, I've become a fan of the SanDisk Cruiser Fit USB-A thumb drives. These are tiny little USB-A thumb drives that protrude out of your port for maybe like 3 millimeters.
Those styles.
Yeah. I love those because I don't like things protruding out of my hardware. And they are available in shocking capacities. I got two 512 gig ones for this machine.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah. So basically, I added a terabyte of storage for not that much money and not that much physical real estate, which is really good. So right now I'm using one of those for storing data for my creative and development projects, including the files for this podcast, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And another is used for storing media. Right now I'm actually using this as a sort of like a YouTube DL box where I just have a bunch of random archived shit that I like the first six episodes of Zaboomafu for some reason. Actually, I think it's the first 12. I have that sitting in the closet, just accumulating media that I'm interested in case it disappears off of YouTube. And as I mentioned, I formatted both of them with BTRFS, which is the state-of-the-art Linux file system. It's technologically sandwiched somewhere between APFS and ZFS in terms of actual functionality, closer to the ZFS side of the scale than APFS. I'm not actively using any of the fancy file system features right now. It's just this was the new file system, and I wanted to play around with it. And I wanted to see, like, is it more complicated to set up than an ext2 or ext4 file system like I'm used to? And the answer is yes, but not by much. So it was still pretty intuitive. It's just, it felt more like actually playing around with APFS in terms of setting up like volume groups and all of that stuff.
Okay, so it has the same concept as container, like logic containers and things like that.
Yeah, they're not named the exact same thing, but the same concepts are basically there. So one of the things I want to do is, since BTRFS has the ability to do data scrubbing to detect and correct potential data corruption, I am very interested in setting that up, and that is one of the features that APFS is missing that John Siracusa loves to remind us about. So I'm excited about that. And technically, like, this file system can also handle like RAID 1, RAID 5, RAID 10, I want to say, but I only have two drives right now, and I'm not sure about that. And possibly I might add some USB 2 drives in there as well if I need more storage that isn't necessarily as fast for archival. But I'm not there yet.
Your own S3 versus Glacier on your Linux server.
Yeah, kind of something like that. So then I set up the SFTP server, and like, you're going to say, well, that's cheating. You get that for free because SSH is running on it. And that's true. but the point I'm trying to make is I fucking hate Samba. It doesn't work. It doesn't work like 95% of the time. And like, the thing I hated the most was when macOS decided, hey, we're getting rid of AppleTalk file sharing and we're only using Samba now. I'm like, no, why did you make the file sharing unreliable? I hate this. So now I'm relying entirely on SFTP for my file transfers. Nemo, which is Cinnamon's file manager, it actually supports adding SFTP folders directly into your sidebar and mounting them like if they are regular drives, which is really, really nice. Whenever I want to pull something off the server, I just have my two USB drives on the server always on the left sidebar, and I just click on them and they show up. It's great. Good job, Cinnamon, continuing to make great user experiences. Over on iOS, where I do a lot of file transfers as well, I'm using Transmit for iOS, which somehow, despite not being sold since 2018, is still the best iOS SFTP client. Not that I'm bitter.
You're not alone, by the way. I'm still using it to when we are, I do the uploads for this podcast. So I'm still rocking Transmit on iOS, and I miss it dearly, even if it still works. One day it will stop working, and then I'll cry.
Yeah. Over on Windows, when I'm recording my episodes, I have a WinSCP shortcut. So you can actually create shortcuts directly to servers in WinSCP. So I just have a link right on my desktop. I can double click and it brings up the folder on the server. So I just drag in my file and then I close it. And right now, I know I'm a fake Panic fan. I don't own Transmit yet on the Mac. Please don't sue me. I'm currently using CyberDeck, but I do want to get Transmit eventually because it's dumb that I don't own Transmit.
You should. It was my Dropbox lion up until we stopped using Dropbox. Intent.
Huh. It's funny you mentioned that because the next thing here on my list is the sync thing. So in recent years, if you've been listening to Apple podcasts at all, Dropbox has gotten rather unsavory and their app does a bunch of shady shit and it's weird. So I have been looking for a better alternative to reduce my reliance on it, and all of the other cloud services are somehow worse, so I didn't use any of them. But I had heard of Sync Thing, but I had never really looked into it, and now that I have looked into it, I feel like a dumbass, because it's the best software discovery I've had in the last year. What Sync Thing is it's essentially peer-to-peer Dropbox with built-in NAT traversal and matchmaking servers to facilitate keeping machines in sync with minimal friction. And here, too, Dukarivya can jump in later and tell us about his experience using it, because I have forced him to use it for the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of technical decision we make for the podcast.
Yeah. So adding machines, basically, you just have to give someone a really long string of characters that they type in as a pairing code. And both of you have to accept the thing, and you check the folders you want to share, and then it's essentially just Dropbox set up between those two machines. No accounts necessary, no port forwarding necessary. It does crazy bullshit to bypass the firewalls. I don't know how it works, but it's magic. It works great. You can sync multiple folders with different clients. So like right now, I have a Limipo folder, which is shared with my Mac and Yukarivya's Mac. I have a work folder, which is shared with my two work laptops, so they can keep in sync, because I have a folder of notes for each of my clients, and I like having those on both of my machines so that if something comes in, I can actually save it in the right place. The big limitation with Sync Thing is that it is just a sync engine. It is not a remote file access interface. So if you're used to things like Synology Drive or Nextcloud or those kinds of platforms, which provide an actual dashboard you can view your file system in, this is not that. This is just a sync engine for folders. And there are client applications available for Windows, Linux, and Mac. And shockingly, like the client applications, well, except for the Windows one, which is kind of shit, the Linux and Mac ones are pretty good. All things considered, they feel relatively platform native, or as platform native as this kind of thing can be. There's also an Android client. The big pain point with Sync Thing is no iOS client, and it kind of makes sense given the limitations of what Sync Thing is.
But still.
Yeah, it kind of sucks. So that is the major omission. For my use case, it doesn't really matter because I can connect to the server via SFTP and all of my folders are already there. So I can see them all there on my iOS machine. But it would be nice to have a real iOS client. And I think someone wrote a blog post as to why they don't have an iOS client and why they'll never have an iOS client. And I haven't read it. So I should go read that.
Oh, well, maybe yeah, you should...
Maybe follow up on the next episode.
And you should send it my way, because maybe I'll go argue with them. But before I'm being mean, I should explain why. The main gist of it is, again, we use that for this podcast, and I do a lot of the typically do a lot of the posting using an iPad. So now to get the file, I have to get it from my Mac, which, again, it's on my iMac. So it's not a laptop I have. I bring around with me, especially if I'm out of town going to see the family or the in-laws. So yeah, I guess if that is to happen, Yannick might have to post the podcast compared to me. So yeah, I'm trying to make it a big deal. It's not really a big deal. It's just that for the needs Yannick and I have, and on my end of the bargain, I do need to have access to the file from iOS, so I guess I'll have to deal with it somehow. But yeah, no, it seems pretty rock solid. On the main thing I would say is, like, yeah, it's a bit kind of techy to configure. Again, you provided the steps and I did zero research. I just followed the step. I'm not the biggest fan of those tools that are more or less a daemon running in the background, and then to interface it, you have to go in the web browser. Again, would you be really surprised that I'm an app person? So having, like, more or less when you open its interface, you end up for me in Safari, and it's pointing to my local host address on a specific port. So it works. It's fine. It's just that I like apps. So if it had a native interface, that would be neat. But again, you're correct that the daemon exposes a menu item in your menu bar. So that part at least feels native.
Yeah, and there are some prefs you can manage within the app, but it's not a ton of it. A lot of it is deferred to the web interface. And I understand, like, they don't want to have to duplicate everything in all the platforms. But yeah, it's not ideal, but it's pretty useful. And I vastly prefer this to using Dropbox.
That's fair. And also, even if I complain about that, that approach of the daemon providing a web interface on your local on your local host is way better than bundling Electron and having a huge ass app.
Yeah.
So, like, take what I said with a grain of salt, but still, for sure, the gold standard would be native apps per platform, but it's costly to do.
So, I want to talk a little bit about what's next for the server, because I have lots of ideas for the server, but I currently don't have the time to work on them. So these are probably going to happen, like, after I get back from my trip in March. So the first thing I want to do is have custom media ingest scripts and maybe even monitoring for Swansong and the podcast. There are a lot of very repetitive things that I do for Swansong and the podcast that could just be automated by having a thing look at a folder and take the files that come in with a specific naming scheme and just do actions on them in the background. And yes, it's going to be slower than if I ran it on my Mac Mini or whatever, but it's fine because it's going to happen in the background and I won't have to think about it. And I'd rather have that. So a couple of things that I'm thinking of that this could happen to, we use Audacity to do noise reduction on the thing. And sometimes when I'm dealing, I don't remember if it's the MP3 file or the M4A file, but it just decides, like, no, this is an open source piece of software. We don't actually want to be able to open that file format. So I have to transcode everything into WAV. So at the very least, I want to have something that just converts to WAV. But then once it's in WAV, I think I should be able to easily write a script that just takes the WAV file that has my audio on the left channel and Yukodivi's audio on the right channel and splits that into two mono files, because I do that manually every single time and it could just be automated. I could just name the files correctly, put them in the folder, and then when I come back, they're all already split correctly and in the right format. And I would save a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, that would be neat, because you could even do that on the shared folder so that a few days after we'd done recording, when you do the editing, it would just be done and ready for you to do the next part.
Yeah, that was the goal. Nice. Similarly, for Swansong, for uninteresting technical reasons, I capture my video at the exact screen resolution of the WonderSwan. So it's like 400 by 200 or something stupid like that. It's probably not exactly that, but I just don't remember off the top of my head. And my videos are 1080p. So I want to have a nearest neighbor upscale of that video so that you get crisp pixel borders on the actual end product. Currently, I'm not even nearest neighbor scaling it correctly. I'm just using Handbrake to upscale it, and it actually gives me blurry borders, which is not what I want. You can do nearest neighbor with FFmpeg, but that requires actually dealing with FFmpeg, and I'm too lazy for that. So it can happen automatically, like, that's great.
That requires research.
Yeah. So if I can have the FFmpeg thing run automatically when I put the file in the folder, that's great. I'll just do that instead. Another thing that's on the project list is automated offsite backups of both USB drives. I've heard about rsync.net, which is kind of like this backup service that a lot of Linux people like, and it looks pretty promising, so I might look into that. And then I don't know if you know about Jellyfin, but it's essentially like another one of those projects like Plex that exists. That's like this media server thing. I'm not sure how I feel about these media server things because they tend to have lots of metadata, automated metadata fetching that is not to my liking, and they present things in weird UI sometimes. But Jellyfin looks like the least offensive of these, so I might give it a try. I've heard that if you don't actually have to transcode anything in real time, this hardware is more than capable of running it correctly. So I might actually try that. And it has clients on... I know it has a client on Xbox. I don't know if it has one on PS5 or anything like that, but I would play around with it. And the Swift iOS client looks really, really nice as well. So that is on my list of things to get to. So now we're at the conclusion. How is Linux after my prolonged absence? And I think this is going to maybe shock a couple people on the show, so get ready. My experience on the on Linux has been pretty damn good, but as usual, your mileage may vary. In recent months, I've seen a couple of people I follow on Mastodon try to give Linux, desktop Linux, a try, and I've seen people with horror stories with the latest two Ubuntu versions, not because it's Ubuntu, just because it's Linux. Sometimes things don't go perfect. For every person that has a great experience with Linux, another person exists that has a terrible experience with Linux. And I just want you to be aware of that. Like, I'm one of the lucky ones. Maybe you're one of the lucky ones too. But if you have a bad experience with Linux, it doesn't inherently mean you're doing something wrong. Sometimes it just fails on you and you're out of luck. One thing I find really cool about Linux is that the range of Linux distributions available today pretty much guarantees that you can find something that is going to make older hardware you have on hand relevant again. There are still many distros with 32-bit support. LMD is actually one of those. You can run it on 32-bit machines. I'm not sure how, but apparently you can. There are still many distros with lighter weight desktop environments like Mate, XFCE, or LXQt, which just fly on lower spec machines. So you can probably find something that is going to work relatively well on lower spec 64-bit machines as well. It, purely from a stats point of view, Cinnamon is significantly lighter than modern GNOME as well. I tried running Fedora Silverblue for a little while, and GNOME does not run well on my ThinkPad, or at least not in Silverblue. I haven't tried any other distribution. And Cinnamon flies on it. It's running essentially the same apps, but GNOME just has more effects and more Chrome that makes it just beefier and harder to run. And the thing I want to sort of underline here is that Linux is a great value. Sure, Apple Silicon laptops are really hard to beat in terms of like overall performance and user experience, but they're also really, really expensive. And you can go a lot further with a used $200 ThinkPad and a Linux install than you can with an iPad or a Chromebook. And I just want to remind people of that because I wasn't necessarily thinking of that before these experiments, and now my perspective has changed a lot. There is a lot more attention and care that appears to be going into the scalability of software on lower spec hardware on Linux in a way that can't be said for Windows and Mac OS. My 2018 Mac Mini is actually as maxed out as you could get an i5 configuration at the time, and it constantly chugs and runs like shit, doing the exact same things that my ThinkPad can do effortlessly with half the RAM and an older CPU. This sort of underscored to me, like, the issues I'm seeing on the Mac right now, they're not issues with the hardware I have, they're issues with macOS being poorly optimized to Intel hardware. And I know, like, obviously Apple Silicon is the focus, but I think Apple Silicon is actually masking optimization issues in macOS that are very apparent if you are running on Intel right now. And just overall, I feel like for a while, the tech industry is spiraling out of control and increasingly out of touch. All of the platforms, the corporate-owned platforms, are chasing services revenue over giving users a good computing platform to work on, including Ubuntu with their Ubuntu Pro thing. And I have just started valuing the added control I have over my computing destiny much more highly, and that makes switching to Linux look more and more enticing every single day. And that is the weird conclusion of this episode. If you remember back to 2020, when I actually had to buy the Mac Mini, knowing that any week after the moment that I bought it, Apple Silicon was about to come out, but I had to buy it because my laptop was falling. At that time, I said, like, well, yeah, I could save money if I went to Linux, but I'm not going to switch to Linux. Like, that's crazy. That's looking less and less crazy every single day. And I don't know. I'm not in the in the market for a new computer. But when I will be, I'm not sure I'm getting a Mac. And that is weird.
Ooh, that's weird for you to say.
Yeah.
As the person that introduced me to the Mac, it's really weird to hear it. Wow. Yeah. So is 2023, was 2023 the year of desktop Linux for you, Nick? It seems like yes.
I don't
still
think so.
Hesitation. Okay.
I think my year of desktop Linux is going to be the year when I actually switch to Linux for everything.
Interesting.
So things to look forward to in future episodes. I will point out that I have not started working on a Cicero version for Linux yet.
Maybe that is what will stop you.
Wait, it's going to stop me from switching because Cicero isn't written on Linux? I can just port it to Linux.
Oh, fair, but okay, sure, okay. I thought you would like it to stay on, but that's okay.
I don't have to use Swift if I switch to Linux. That's a great selling point right there.
Oh boy.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, let's stop here. I was about to ask another dumb question, and I was like, nope, not going to ask that. Good. So you'll be able to find all the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/220, so 220. You can find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. You can find us individually there too. I am at luco at mastodon.social, and you can find Nick at
Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.